Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks. This week,
waking up with breakfast,
the inside story on M&C Saatchi's massive CommBank rebrand from a man who knows.
Are the Kiwis really better at ads than the Aussies?
Fairfax staff strike over outsourcing of production to New Zealand.
Hungry Jack's finds its feminine side.
And Lara Bingle set to debut.
So welcome to the studios of CBS Interactive and a big Mumbrella Cast this week. Some big stories going on and some big guests as well. Joining us, Ben Welsh, ECD at creative agency M&C Saatchi, who this week unveiled CommBank's new direction. Hello, Ben.
Hello, everyone.
And Paul Henry, co-anchor for Ten's Breakfast. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Also with us, podcast producer Colin.
Hello.
And Paul, we'll start with you.
Did that sound weird when I said hi like that?
A little bit.
Hi.
it sounded measured.
Yeah. Because I don't normally sound measured. And I was just worried because I heard it back and I thought, no, that sounds weird.
No, that's not what you want to go for at all.
No,
so just, how are you adjusting to your Australian audience?
It's hard to tell when you're on television because you're so extraordinarily removed from the audience. And that's why a lot of people, I think, gravitate towards television because, contrary to popular belief, they are introverts. And so you are shielded by electronic equipment from the actual audience.
Although, of course, at regular moments, the audio of your viewers does break its way onto air.
It does, which is fantastic. I love that interactive aspect. And that's one of the problems, of course, with television. It quite often cannot be as interactive as some other media. So it's great that we can actually get the viewers' voices on air.
In the data there, does it actually feel any different to what you were doing in New Zealand? I mean, you know, I watch YouTube clips of you presented breakfast in New Zealand. It feels very similar. You know, you're on the left. There's a female co-host on the right. Relatively similar set.
We're relatively similar countries as well, aren't we? The thing for me is it's always going to be like that because it isn't an act. That's just what I do. And so I just go into the studio and do it. So it does feel very similar. There are quite a few differences which you have to get your head around. The big one for me, of course, is that I hadn't done television for quite some time. And so getting up at that hour in the morning, which is truly godforsaken. It is not morning, it is night. And I never in the years that I was doing it got used to it, and I'm sure I never will.
And have you bonded with your colleagues yet?
You know, it takes a long time to bond, especially because, you know, it takes much longer in a situation, as you would probably know, when you're on air with them, because you have to almost bond with them twice. You've got to bond with them as human beings who you work with, but then you've also got to bond in that sort of second tier, that sort of performance level. And that just takes a while. And you can't try and do it. You just have to be there long enough for it to actually happen, or not.
And I guess it's just, you know, little things like knowing, okay, for the next link, who's going to go first.
Yeah.
Just things like that, which comes naturally in time, I suppose.
Yeah, and it needs to come naturally, and you want it to come as naturally as quickly as possible, because it is never going to work properly if you spend 5 minutes before you go on saying, I'll say this, you say that. When I say this, you say that. You know, because it will always, it's like programming by numbers, which is hideous.
But I wonder whether you're an absolute nightmare to co-present with, because fair to say you're quite a big personality. I suspect the others might find it difficult to come in sometimes.
I think I'm very, very generous. You've probably noticed that in the short time that you've been with me. What happens is I have this sort of idea in my head of where I'm going, which I haven't really worked through, and it happens as I go. And I don't really like being interrupted once I've started that, you know, because I'm on a track. But once it's reaching fruition, I'm then quite happy to sort of sit back for sometimes seconds on end while other people do things, you know. But I am, and I'm quite supportive of, as you need to be in a co-host situation, you need to be supportive. But the key thing, and you mentioned it just now, the key thing is to be able to anticipate what the person that you're with is going to do next. And until you get to that stage, then there's always going to be that potential for awkwardness.
And TVNZ, I guess over time, have become a very well-honed machine. You are coming into a very new program. How are you finding just the routines behind the scenes? Because I'm guessing they're not really in place yet.
No, that's exactly right. And the thing is, you know, everyone thinks that breakfast is the people that they see on television, but as you guys know, you know, much more of breakfast is the ice under the water. And it's new for all of them. You know, obviously, it's not, television is not new for them, although it is for some of the production team. But the whole idea of producing 3 hours of live television 5 days a week is very new, and so everyone's sort of catching up at different levels to the program as the program is sort of evolving and growing.
And does that create any frustrations for you?
Yep.
In what way?
In every way. Where do I begin? And sometimes you don't know what those frustrations are going to be in advance. Some of them you do. But, you know, you want everyone to be on the same page at the same time, but you haven't actually told them which page it is you're going to be on. So, and you can quite often hear people turning, and I'll call for shots. And it would be so much easier if I just asked them in advance of the commercial break that that's what I wanted.
No, when but you
I
say didn't shots, know I you, wanted you mean in the televisual sense?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, probably in a few months' time, I'll be calling for shots in another sense. But yeah, I'll call for something. And I can just imagine, you know, there are 20 people in the control room who are under their breath thinking, why didn't that ass just, you know, tell us that this is what he was going to want, and it could have just been there.
So we've probably not yet seen the best of the show, though.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I would hope that in 6 months the same would be true. You know, if it is truly going to evolve properly, it will take a long time to get to its best. But it's a long way away from its best now.
Ratings? Do you take that personally?
No, God, I don't take anything personally. Hang on. Is that true? I'm painfully honest. And there may be things that I take personally, but certainly nothing associated with work do I take personally.
But to the extent that, you know, you'd like to rate really, really well.
Oh, God,
you'd like
yeah.
to beat
yeah.
the other guys.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would like it to be number one. And I would like the ratings to be much, much better than they are now. Do I take it personally that they're not? Absolutely not. It's not because of me. I mean, it's a combination of factors, not the least of them being that there are two Goliaths in breakfast that have been around for a long time that are doing a half decent job. So we have to do better than a half decent job to persuade those people away. But more importantly than that, even that isn't enough. People have to know we're doing better than a half decent job. So they have to be told in other ways that we're on. And you know, you say, well, and from an advertising point of view, you know, you can tell people a lot of times something before they actually, you know, before it beds in.
Paul, at the moment, breakfast is rating about average 30,000 to 40,000. Big rivals around 300,000, almost 400,000.
Yep.
How long do you think it'll take before you catch them up?
You know, I mean, the answer to that is I don't know. And I mean, you could ask a crueler question. You could say, will we ever catch them up?
Right.
And the answer to that would also be I don't know. The reality is I would hope in 6 months' time or within the next 6 months, we will be producing a product which anyone with a modicum of intelligence will be able to see is at least as good, if not substantially better than the others. Now, that still doesn't mean you're going to catch them up, because it's going to take a long time for people to find that out one way or another, and it's probably going to cost a lot in terms of advertising. But we are not as good as we should be yet. We are getting better, and we will continue to get better.
And you mentioned it's people finding you as well. Do you need a moustache gate in this market to get yourself talked about?
No, we don't need one. We don't need one. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't be a good idea to have one, but I wouldn't want one right now. And I certainly would never try for one. I mean, if it happens, it'll be because it just happens. It'll just be because one of the things that I just said without planning it or anything in advance gains traction. But that's certainly not what we need now. What we need to do now is get better and better at what we're doing.
For those who aren't aware, moustache gate was when you pointed out
a
physical attribute of a female guest on the show.
Yes. That's correct.
Actually, shall I read these out? Are they a bit iffy? I'll leave it up to you. Shall I read these out? They're a bit iffy.
Please don't.
Oh, no, they say
please
yes.
Please don't, I beg you.
They say yes.
Please don't.
This one just says moustache. Everyone in my ear is saying don't read it out.
Read it out. Don't read it out.
It's about a guest that we had on TV. Seriously. This one says, I have no idea what Stephanie Mills was thinking going on telly with that enormous moustache. Wax is cheap, you know. Are Mo's for female Greenpeace members standard issue? Says this other one.
I'm having nothing to do with this. Let's move on to Dancing with the Stars, shall we?
All right.
Thank you.
Let's move on to Dancing with the Stars.
Crisis,
I mean, you know, it's just people
averted.
Noticing things. It's people
the
watching
second couple.
And noticing. And I noticed as well, and I thought, that is a moustache on a lady.
Oh.
It was a moustache on a lady. I just noticed it. And people can say what they see. It's just television, isn't it? You know?
I've got to ask you another question, Paul. Also, when you were on TV in New Zealand, there was an incident about the mispronunciation of an Indian lady's name.
We'll play a little clip of it here.
Also, the dipshit woman. God, what's her name? Dick shit. Is it dick shit?
Dick sit.
Oh,
dick sit.
Oh, dick sit.
Dick sit.
It just
no.
looks different to what you say.
Well, it looks like dick shit.
I know it does, Paul, but it's not. that. It's There's, Dixit.
There she is, there. Sheila Dixit. Sheila... Anyway, and it's so appropriate because she's Indian. So she'd be Dickin' shit, wouldn't she? Do you know what I mean?
Paul, her name...
Walking along the street...
...is Ms. Dixit.
Oh, Dixit. Well, that's what I said, isn't it?
No.
No, you did not.
Before you took the job at 10, did they give you the hard word and say, look, Paul, you can't say stuff like that? Or indeed, did they encourage that sort of thing to attract an audience?
Okay, well, so my answer to that would be neither of those two. They certainly didn't sit me down and say, you can't say things like that. But I would go further and say, they obviously knew that that's my background. So I suppose you would have to say, they didn't really need to say anything to me about being controversial. They know quite clearly that I don't set out to be controversial, but that because I just say what's on my mind, I can be controversial. So the fact that they said nothing and employed me knowing that that was my background, it would indicate that they were happy. And they were happy for me to be myself. And they say, you know, 10 say that they are edgier than the others. And there are things that I've seen in the way they operate that would indicate that they are just freer spirits to a greater degree. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, there's a corporate structure, so they're not completely free. There are shareholders that want their slice of the pie. But yeah, there's a level of excitement about the place.
I must admit, because when you were announced as the host, mostly we knew you from YouTube as that bloke who might be a bit racist. Mm. So I kind of, my impression before seeing you present was I was going to kind of see this, you know, dumb racist being offensive for offence sake,
yes,
in order to get people talking. I suspect it's actually somewhat more nuanced than that.
Well, and because people will often say, and there was a lot of pre-publicity before I came here, from people that had picked those things up on YouTube, which in reality is mostly what you can get of me outside of New Zealand, comparing me to Carl Sandilands, and they used the phrase shock jock. Now, that I can shock as well as the next person, probably better than most, but I don't set out to shock, and I think that's the definition of a shock jock. That is their persona, that's their gig. They set out to do it. I never set out to do it.
I enjoyed your acceptance speech, by the way, for the People's Choice Awards.
Thank you. And it was genuine, you know. Everyone came up to me and said, oh, you know, did you write that?
It was reading out a hate letter.
A hate letter
from a fan's the wrong word, really, isn't it?
It's hard to know, isn't it? Some people love to hate. but the funny thing was that it was interesting that because there was one line in there that I was quite uncomfortable with, just because it referred to AIDS. And I was quite uncomfortable, but I determined when I put that letter in my pocket, and I hardly ever read them, but it was one of those ones, you know, if you're in this business, you recognize the handwriting of people that are going to be doozies. And from the envelope, I could tell this was going to be a real doozy. So I did open it and look at it, and it was great. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to read this, I can't edit it. You know, if you're going to read it, you just have to read the whole thing. And so there was one line in there, as I say, that I was a bit uncomfortable with. But I'd written it, whereas in actual fact, I was the stickler for making sure that I didn't change any of it.
And you were okay about the line about the person shitting on your face?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, as I implied, it said a lot more about the person that wrote the letter than it did about me.
We'll play a little clip of it here.
And the new idea People's Choice Award goes to, I have the envelope, but I have the answer as well, Paul Henry.
I like always to carry just a reminder of how people really feel. I would say at this point, as I read these few words, that these are the words of a very, very passionate fan. So you have to understand that the language, obviously, Phil Goff is here. How are you, Phil? You have to understand David Garrett is here too, but he's come under a different name. You have to understand that this is a very passionate fan, and so you'll have to read between the lines. Paul Henry, you are the most insulting little self-conceited little mongrel prick on TV. I would love Susan Boyle to shit on your ugly face. Pamela Anderson to give you AIDS, David Hasselhoff to punch you on the nose, preferably before Susan shits on you. And the writer, and I can't credit him or her because they haven't put their name on this letter, ends with the, I think, quite memorable line, you fucking poofter, pommy mongrel prick, die you cunt.
Now, Paul, the other rumour we've got is you'll be the new host of Can of Worms.
I've heard that. In fact, did I see that in the paper somewhere?
It's probably has
Who
been
told
reported,
you?
I think. Yeah, you know how it is, the grapevine.
I don't, because I haven't been here long enough to be part of the grapevine yet.
So do you want the gig? Would you do it?
It's a great program. I've actually seen the program. And I think it's a great, when I say it's a great program, it's a brilliant concept.
It's on your network as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a brilliant concept.
Have you had any conversations with them about it?
Yep, I have. But I mean, I have no idea who will be hosting Can of Worms.
Genuinely.
Yeah. I wouldn't have said it like that if I'd known.
You'd certainly be on it though.
If I'd known and I wouldn't want to say, what would I say if I'd known and I wouldn't want to say? Because I despise people that say, I have no comment. But I genuinely don't know who will be hosting that program.
Next, the CommBank rebrand.
This week saw the launch of CommBank's big rebrand around the word can. So, Ben, I'm going to throw over to you for this one. So, M&C Saatchi was behind the campaign. Has it unfolded as you expected?
Probably better. I mean, I think it was obviously going to be very watched, because it was very much anticipated. The pitch started last year. The decision was made at the end of February. And I think for the last 3 months, people have been wondering what's going to happen. And there have been some good banking ads done, campaigns done in the past. And Goodbyes did a very good job too. So I think it was a lot of pressure on us. And we were confident that it would work, but we're always nervous about how our peers are going to see us, particularly some blogs that are out there. So it was with many beers that we celebrated the launch of that, really.
And a couple of brands ambushed it. Heritage Bank one, ANZ another. I spoke to Andy Lark about this, the marketing director at CommBank. He said it helped you. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, Greenpeace did too. So it was one of those moments where you think, it starts happening. We saw the Heritage one and we went, oh, is this a good thing? Should we be worried about this? And then we went, no, this is good. This is really good. And then the more it happened, the better it is, because all it does is create more chat. And the whole point of that initial phase was to create chat and anticipation. And if I can use the term fluffer, I think it was kind of the role of that is getting everyone excited about what's going to come next. So you warm up the market. I mean, it is like the guy who comes on in a comedy thing and sort of says, tells a few jokes that aren't as good as the.
So I didn't think that was what a fluffer was.
What did you think a fluffer
similar,
was?
It's a similar role. I mean, it might be a different
comedy,
audience.
Yes.
A different audience.
A different entertainment audience.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah. But you have a task at hand and you need to warm up your audience. And that's I think there's a similarity there. So it went down really well. It was. And it was an intro. I mean, 90 to 95% of the work that you're going to see was done for the pitch, which hardly ever happens. I mean, I think it's the first in the time I've been working in advertising. There were a few changes along the way. I'm glad to say everything got better. I mean, it was one of those things where you actually are much happier at the end when the work's about to go out than you are normally when you've gone from a pitch idea to the real world.
It's a $100 million client. I mean, that's absolutely massive. Can you say how much spend has gone behind the initial launch and how much is to come?
I can't because I don't know. But I think clearly quite a lot, because there's been I think it's probably one of the biggest spends for that period, without doubt.
Well, let's take a listen to Ode to Can.
There's a four-letter word as offensive as any. It holds back the few, puts a stop to the many. You can't climb that mountain, you can't cross the sea, you can't become anything you want to be. You can't hit a century, they can't find a cure. She can't think about leaving or searching for more. Because can't is a word with the habit of stopping the ebb and flow of ideas. It keeps dropping itself where we know in our hearts it's not needed, and saying don't go when we could have succeeded. But those four little letters that end with a T, they can change in an instant when shortened to three. We can take off the T, we can do it today. We can move forward, not back. We can find our own way. We can build, we can run, we can follow the sun. We can push, we can pull. We can say, I'm someone who refuses to believe that life can't be better with the removal of one insignificant letter.
Paul asked me the other day how much I thought Toni Collette got paid, so I guessed at $1 million, but I was kind of bluffing.
Can I put a guess in? I guess 1.2.
Well, you're both very wrong.
But too high or too low?
I don't think, if she cost that much, I don't think we would have gone with her. I don't want to do her a disservice by saying she wasn't that much, but she wasn't that much.
100,000?
She was more than that. Well, we could do this all day.
Yeah, we could do it all day, but as we do it, we'll get closer and closer to the truth.
But somewhere between $100,000 and $1 million, you'll find the price of Toni Collette.
So sort of about $700,000.
It's always delicate having conversations with stars because
their agents hate to talk about money, don't they?
Yeah, and nobody really wants to be part of advertising. But she's only playing this one role. She did it because she liked the content. She is perfectly happy with the bank too. There's none of this, I don't like them sort of thing going on.
Yeah, so there was a discussion as to whether, you know, personally she felt as if she was selling out by being an ad campaign. I mean, she has been in an ad campaign before, right?
I think there's a discussion about, is this person right for the bank?
Yeah.
And that's the initial discussion. We did have a number of other people and we put them into research and we ended up deciding that Toni would be the perfect, partly because she's a woman, partly because she's got the most amazing Cannes story, having been a truck driver's daughter in
Blacktown
and now being Hollywood. And her roles, I mean, I don't think she's ever done a bad job. She's never been in a bad movie. She is an incredibly smart, likable person. So there are other people that are perhaps more famous, but I think with fame comes more contention. So
she also mastered that very much that sort of motherly, that caring, that nurturing style. And that, were you looking specifically for that?
we weren't looking for that, but I think it was a good thing to have. I mean, we were looking for someone who could genuinely say those words as if they were their own words, that they were relevant to her. And she actually changed a line of the verse. She can't.
It was think for believe.
Go overseas. No, she did that. I was annoyed about that, but doesn't matter. It still comes.
And she
across.
Did it after the booklet had gone to press as well.
Yeah. No, because it just doesn't scan quite as well with believe. But it was a really good take, so we went with that. But no, there was another line earlier in she can't go overseas or something that she wrote because it was very true to her experience that when she was here, oh, you'll never make it in Hollywood. But she did.
Now winning CommBank, when you guys had lost ANZ and there were an awful lot of jobs on the line within the agency, I'm guessing. It must have been unbelievable pressure just to win the pitch in the first place.
I think, yeah, I mean, every pitch, you never go into a pitch half-heartedly. I mean, you'll never win it unless you set out to win it. So there's always a lot of pressure.
Someone quite senior agent said it was a really dark place before, you know, CommBank came in.
It was. I mean, this time, we go back to October last year. We had Qantas pitching, Westfield pitching, Woolies pitching, Optus pitching. Optus pitches last almost a year. So that was, and they always come around every 3 years. We know we're going to have one. It might be every 4 years. And we were pretty confident about that. Woolies was a whole bunch of new people in town, so you always worry about what's going to happen with that. Qantas was, again, an awful lot of things going on. Qantas, so that was a concern. So the bank was, yes, there was a lot of pressure on. But I think in a way, we didn't respond with what you might normally do when there's a lot of pressure, which is to go in and cover your bases and say, we could do this, we could do that, we could do that, and have three ideas. We went in with one idea that we believed was absolutely right for them, given their brief to us, and given the time Australia is in right now. And it hasn't changed since then. But there was an article in the Herald by the economics commentator, and I can't remember his name, but he's a very good wise man, and he was saying, "Are we a country that's talking itself into a recession?" And that was so true at that moment that we are always talking about how things are bad when they're not incredibly good. So this notion that you can't, yes, you can, was born very much out of that time and what the bank did.
By that rationale, Ben, do you think you're treading on dangerous ground to use a negative word like can't in the teaser?
No. I mean, it worked. It was intriguing. We didn't accredit it. Nobody knew what it was for. It was just there, and people were looking at it, and there were people taking pictures of it. We saw people going on the site and Googling on their phones, but it was kind of, I think it did its job. I mean, the idea isn't can't, the idea is can. We did actually work out, do we need to go out there with this teasy bit? I mean, we could just go straight out there. But we just thought, no, it's a good thing. And the internal audience is so important. They're a very large organisation. They've had 4 years of Determined to be Different, which shifted things very positively for the bank internally. Doing a big thing externally helps do a big thing internally. And I think it's gone down so well within the organisation. I've never seen such a brilliant incel done by the guys, Andy and his team.
How popular was the Cannes site? Because I can remember driving along seeing it and then saw the website at the bottom and I thought, how tiny would your life have to be that you see one word and you actually go to the website to find out what it means?
I can sympathise with that view, but people do. And the funny thing is that the people that do go there will also click like or email or send to a friend. So there is a viral element in there. And we did a lot of work. And every time you went there, you go and find something different. So it was...
So you were sort of... Each time there was a cookie, so you were seeing a different image each time.
Yeah. So I would send you a picture of a hamster that can't stop.
I liked the cute kitten best, actually. Yeah. That made me like the bank 60%
more. So you actually
more.
Did this?
I did it, but I didn't.
He's one of the sad people you just mentioned.
Yeah, I fear... And the question is, was I doing it professionally or not? That's the...
So you actually, when people went there, it didn't explain it. It just hooked them into this evil world you had created on the internet.
Completely. Completely. And but another way of considering that evil world is it was a moment's entertainment, a moment's reward for doing it.
Ah, the glass is half full after all.
Yes.
And you went to, you and Combank went to a great deal of trouble to make sure that all of the trade press was well briefed beforehand. Why do you care so much what your own industry thinks? Because it must have been such a busy week, and yet a significant amount of time was invested in...
It was a very busy week. We don't normally do that with big campaigns. I mean, this was very much Andy Lark's sort of... He said in America, this is how things work, having come from the States. He said, this is what you do with a big campaign. So it was kind of an unusual situation for us, but I think it actually worked really well.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I do. Yeah.
I think it's not... I don't think we spun it in any way. I think we just told people what was happening and what was going on. Here's the story, here's the work.
Now, the word can has been used in various forms in campaigns, most notably Obama's Yes, We Can. Was there a concern that the word was overused?
No. I mean, it was a funny thing. I mean, we had a whole bunch of ideas. We had various favourites from time to time when we were going through the process, and then we just kept coming back to this thing about Combank Can and that it really was about enabling you to do things and the simplest way of doing it. And yes, as people talk about just do it and various things, that there is it's wonderful to have an idea that is an ethos, not just a line. Because most advertising, and there was even a website we discovered that had all these bank lines that you can go and find out, do your own bank line, and they're all the same. They're all promising dreams. They're all selling, whereas the brutal simplicity of can was just, well, you know, we can help you do this, you can do this with us. And because they got the right technology and the right people, no one else can actually own that. And then the other wonderful thing was Combank has the words C, A, and N in them. And I don't think any of the works, the TV that happens next has this ending that ties those two things together. So Combank becomes Can.
Mm-hmm. So, as the three letters kind of stay and the word kind of merges. You obviously had you had one pretty bad day of PR in the trade press this week where somebody linked to, firstly somebody discovered a story from 1999 about an MNC Saatchi campaign in the UK using the can positioning that started off with Khan as a teaser and then obliterated it, and very effectively made sure that all of the trade press saw it and reported it heavily. Categorically, no one at MNC here in Australia was aware of that campaign.
We weren't. I mean, we don't...
And does it matter anyway?
I don't think it matters. I mean, the guys... The bizarre thing is we, having done that campaign, having won the business. Tom and Tom were in London talking to the guys in London. They showed them all the work. And there was no one at that point sort of went, oh, hang on a minute. Didn't we do that back in 99? There was nothing that popped up. So there was no sort of sense that that it had been done. It was just completely forgotten. And I think the other thing is 1999 is so long ago that we certainly didn't have an intranet, and many of us didn't even have computers. And the sort of idea of what's happening on the other side of the world was judged now. You go, well, how the hell didn't we know? But judged then, you go, well, why would you know? And I think there's probably an awful lot of information on websites around the world of what's happened in the past that we're not across now. And it's embarrassing. It'd be nice if it hadn't happened, but I don't think it matters in the long run. I mean, I really don't.
Next, the Bledisloe of advertising. So sparked by an ad for New Zealand supermarket New World, Robin wrote a piece this week arguing that New Zealand is better at making good ads than Australia. Now, probably before we turn to Robin, let's get the Kiwi consumer perspective on that, Paul. You've been exposed to some Australian ads now. You've been exposed to plenty of...
I don't know that I've been exposed to enough to make a call on that, actually. I mean, New Zealand, they do produce some very, very good ads. But I've seen some good ads over here as well. So I don't know that I could make a call. Not substantially different, I wouldn't have thought.
Would you happily settle down in front of the television when you're in New Zealand and think, oh, good, the ads are coming on?
No. And neither would I do that here.
Ben, is it a fair observation, do you think, that Robin makes, that for the size of the market, New Zealand just creates more good stuff?
I think they have more success internationally, so it's fair on that at an award level. I think they are, as a nation, more interested in advertising. I remember something from 99 that I do remember. When we won tourism and we did 100% pure New Zealand, there was an uproar in Parliament that Saatchi's had lost the account. And it was, I think, 40% of the country or more than that knew who Saatchi and Saatchi were and what they did. And were, because Kevin Roberts was from New Zealand, so they're incredibly proud of it, I suppose. But I think they do certainly... what's the term? They do better than they should per head, but I think
punch above their weight.
Punch above their weight. That's it. But they are a spirited lot.
That's the byline for New Zealand, actually. New Zealand, it punches above its weight. That's because it weighs such a small amount.
And I do. I think what we never see is the crap that they produce, because the only things you guys pick up is all the good stuff that we produce. And if we sat down and watched an hour of TV in New Zealand, we'd probably get tired of the sheep dip ads after a while.
This is the argument I would make, and hopefully Robin's going to disagree with me to keep it interesting. But I always get the sense that, you know, for instance, when I first started covering Australia, having worked in the UK, people would sort of say, oh, you know, the ads in Britain must be so much better. And it's just like the top 10% are really good, yeah, and the bottom percent are terrible. And then you've got this 80% in the middle, if my maths is correct, which is kind of awry. And I'd argue it's proportionally the same.
And the saying goes that 80% of the TV advertising you see anywhere in the world is awful. I probably agree with that. Apart from Argentina, strangely, where advertising is art, apparently, in my experience. But yeah, no, it's just an observation based on every ad that I've seen come out of New Zealand. Granted, I do get fed the good stuff in every category, from supermarkets to anti-drink driving ads, is a league above what I've seen in Australia. And it was Ted Horton who does the ads for Coles who said that advertising in New Zealand is like playing tennis without a net, because it's so much easier to convince a client in New Zealand to buy the work. Mm. Whereas in Australia, the clients are far more conservative.
I think also the point that you were making before is interesting, because I think there is a higher awareness of the business of advertising amongst average New Zealanders than there probably is in Australia.
Yes, I possibly agree with that, although I couldn't really qualify that. But what do you think, Ben, about conservative clients in Australia? Are they more conservative here than in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think there's a I mean, it's not an original statement, but I think it's very true that in New Zealand that you do have fewer levels to go through when you have an idea than you have here. Scandinavia, interestingly, has the reputation that New Zealand does in Europe for doing amazing ads because, and I remember many years ago seeing a speech by some Norwegian talking about the reason their ads were great was because they could just ring someone up and say, here, we've got this idea for an ad. Oh, yeah, it's very funny. We do it. And that was kind of how it worked. And I'm sure New Zealand's a bit more
Someone told me that if you want to cut through with outdoor advertising in New Zealand, there's literally one key billboard, and if you buy that billboard, you'll get people's attention. Sort of,
well,
somewhere
there's more than one.
Well, clearly.
There are two. One in Auckland, one in Wellington.
Since we got that printing press, you know, you'd be surprised.
But a specific spot in Auckland where, you know, that's the one that the good ad gets put up on.
Yeah. And you can tell the clients that can afford those because the companies, and there are only a couple of companies that own those spots, you look at the schedule of costs and you can tell which ones they are. There are probably three in Auckland. I don't think you'd bother putting up a hoarding anywhere else in the country. There are probably three spots in Auckland that if you manage those, everyone will find out about whatever it is you're advertising.
Next, a bad week for journos.
This week has been a bad week for print journalists at the two major establishments. On Monday, it was reported that News Limited would be announcing hundreds of job cuts, possibly as early as next week. This was followed on Tuesday by Fairfax announcing that it was moving production of several of its regional papers offshore to New Zealand. Then more drama on Wednesday night when Fairfax journalists went on strike, leaving production of Thursday's papers to a skeleton staff and the websites on autopilot. So Tim, we scrambled to cover this. It was quite late at night, wasn't it, that Fairfax put out the press release. Mm. What do you make of it?
Yeah, we scrambled to cover it because the Fairfax journalists were unavailable too. Firstly, as we're recording this on Thursday morning, Thursday's paper isn't too bad. But of course, by the time they actually walked at about 5 o'clock, it had mostly been produced, mostly gone to press. So it's a very early edition, and I'm sure if anything had happened in of significance in the evening, it would have missed it. And we've seen more sort of AAP copy. I suspect that by the time this podcast is going up, Friday's paper will be far more of a debacle because that's a whole day's lost production. So, you know, that's not going to look good in the Age, in the Herald, and then the regional papers as well. The problem I always have with this, I think, yes, it's terribly, terribly sad that production is being outsourced and subs do a great job. Any person like myself who's been up to local papers knows that they save you from making yourself look like an idiot when they have better local knowledge than you, and they just save you from making stupid errors that junior reporters do, some of it because of local knowledge. So, it's a bad thing. But if I was Greg Highwood and I was running Fairfax and I saw the business model changing, then I'm, you know, clearly he's sitting there saying to himself, okay, well, look, there are compromises that I've got to make in order to keep getting the products out, transition to this digital world. And some of those are going to be things which are going to reduce the quality of the thing that probably won't be there in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. So I'm not sure I would do any differently if I was in his situation, despite the fact that, you know, I'd like to think that if there was a picket line of those journalists and I was in their situation, I don't think I would cross it.
Yeah, no, I read the Herald this morning and had a good look through it. A lot of expensive-looking ads. I do wonder, in the days that follow, will advertisers want to pull their advertising, do you think, just because they'll be adjacent to copy that's written by someone in another country, possibly, or, you know.
Do you know, the weird thing is, I think tomorrow's paper, there'll be people who buy it out of curiosity. It's a bit like when I was in the UK, the Daily Telegraph lost a night's production when the IRA or one of the Irish sort of terrorism bodies let off a small bomb just outside Canary Wharf and they were evacuated. And the paper came out half empty. You know, there were literally blank pages, some full, with just a little typed message on the front page, literally done on an old typewriter saying this is an emergency edition. It sold out because, of course, everyone was curious to see how it's going to be. So I'm not sure that Fridays will be here, but it's if we get some sort of repeated industrial action that it potentially becomes an issue, whereas I suspect this might this might be it. This is the protest, and that's it. Paul, would you? You're of the journalistic side. Would you cross a picket line?
Yes, I would. I'm right wing, and especially. I mean, I've just been listening to your introduction to this. You know, it's been a bad week. It's 2012. It's extraordinary. The newspapers are still here. We were waiting for a bad week to happen. You look around. We've all got iPads here. There isn't a newspaper to be seen. You know, they do have to cut their cloth. And that's what they're doing. And I'm sure that the journalists, no matter how militant they are, and I can understand they're upset about jobs going, but I'm sure they must understand in the real world, they're intelligent people, that the model is changing. And it is, as you suggested before, going to be a completely different landscape in 5 years' time. I'm just surprised that it's as similar now as it has always been. I would have thought it would have changed much more rapidly.
Do you still read newspapers?
I do, but we're sitting in a room now surrounded by people that are fascinated by news, and also I'm not illiterate from a technology point of view, but I'm as close to it as I'm happy to be, and so I'm not comfortable getting my news from a terminal.
How do you feel about the concept of striking?
I'm not happy with it as a concept at all. I can understand that it's all right for the lower classes. I mean, it's what they do.
Tim, you've got to mention your T-shirt, surely.
Ah, yes, I'm wearing my...
It can't be an accident.
I haven't read it.
Surely.
What does it say?
Save a journalist, buy a newspaper.
I actually dug it out of the back of the cupboard today because it seemed like an appropriate day to be wearing it. Ben, what are your habits? Do you read papers?
I read the paper.
Every day?
Yeah, I look through it every day. I mean, I read it more at the weekend. I'm in my favourite paper's The Guardian, and I go to that website every day, and I think it's the best newspaper website in the world. I think they've nailed it really well, and I think their sales are still quite healthy. They've turned the newspaper into a habit. I mean, your show on Channel 10 in the morning, the reason 7 and 9 do so well is it's a habit. And at that time of day, it's really hard to change your habits because everyone's half asleep.
Absolutely. So, and you're right when you say the paper's the habit, because if I want to know something that's happening straight away, I will go to the internet and I'll look at the newspaper site or one of the other news sites. But to actually read the news, I'll pick up a newspaper.
Yeah, I guess it'll change. There'll be a generation of people that don't give a shit about newspapers, but there is an emotional connection that you have. I think one of the saddest things about this, if we lose newspapers, is we lose newspaper ads. Because I think banner ads and page takeovers are all wonderful things. But as a writer, I think there's something, one of the most rewarding things is to pen a really good
long copy ad.
Long copy or short copy. I mean, I remember I wrote the last ad for Concord when that retired, and it was a print press ad, and it said, "Retirement at 27, the true measure of success." And that would never run anywhere else. And I felt really good about it. Never won anything, but it was a fucking good ad, and I was very proud of that. And you won't get to do stuff like that.
But you could do that on a billboard, couldn't you?
Yeah, but yes, but they probably wouldn't invest.
Yeah.
Certainly not those top three ones in New Zealand, but those and banner ads are a different. There is a different thing in a newspaper. You read a newspaper, and something you're reading because you're interested in this, and you're prepared. And there are headlines everywhere, and you're prepared for that. Banner ad, it's a bit like reading the newspaper, and the TV keeps coming on, and it really is quite a different sort of art. And I think I would miss the Caxtons would never be the same again, which would be a tragedy.
These are the newspaper advertising awards. In fact, they've sort of widened beyond that now, haven't they? Really? Probably for that reason.
Ben, can I ask, do you think, you mentioned habits earlier on, do you think advertisers are set in their ways, stuck into habits in terms of buying newspaper advertising? Or do you think they'll read a story like this about Fairfax journalists going on strike and think, God, this now is an absolute threshold? Beyond this, I'm not going to start. I'm not going to continue to buy newspaper advertising.
I think one of the laments is that when creative agencies and media agencies split up, what used to where an idea was born, and it was you had one voice telling a client what they should do with that idea. Now you have two voices, maybe even more, with the role that publications themselves play, particularly online now, in what they can do. So I think the habits, there's some bad habits now, and I think the closer we can all work, I think we'll all end up in bed together again much more closely, because I think that's what clients will want. And if I go back to CommBank, I think we had a wonderful synergy working with Icon on that, where everything just worked and it just happened together the way it should do. And ideas were, the media was chosen for the idea rather than, here's a media plan, we know this works, we've done it before, which can be the way other companies operate. So, yeah, there are too many. New Zealand's more experimental and braver, possibly because there's a less of investment involved and the rest of the world's not really going to notice if you stuff it up in Australia.
Paul, you've worked with commercial media a lot over the years. What's your kind of view on those kind of people over in advertising agencies and marketers? Are they just a sort of unnecessary distraction?
Not at all. No, I think they're a necessary distraction, but a distraction nonetheless. I think I've got a lot of admiration for them because it's true theatre. And I was a program maker to have the kind of budget per second that they have. And some of it is absolute theatre, very cleverly thought out theatre with an economic imperative. So I've got a lot of time for them.
Who are the sponsors on your show?
I don't even know. That's how much time I've got for them. I don't even know that we have actual sponsors. Hoi polloi of advertisers.
Last time I was in the studio, I did notice there seemed to be an awful lot of Campbell's Real Stock. So I'm on the kitchen set. So I'm assuming that Campbell's must be some form of sponsor.
They probably just gave us a crate of something. We'll sit it on the bench, in return for it. We're still at the stage now where we're doing things for crates of things.
Did I notice that your floating tray of apples has disappeared now?
Oh, that's been gone a long time. And I don't know why it was there in the first place. Don't know why it disappeared.
Yeah, this was just like a sort of random bowl of apples.
There was an awful lot of randomness, though, wasn't there, in the early days, which has disappeared in a random fashion. Yeah. So why it was there and why it went, these are all questions I can't answer.
Next, Hungry Jack's targets women.
This week saw burger chain Hungry Jack's shift its focus to women after overhauling the brand's menu to be more health conscious. The ad sees a tattooed rock chick in a break from rehearsing with her band to bite into a burger. Sorry, I'm actually getting depressed as I'm reading this. With every bite, she loses a piece of her rock identity, losing the tattoos and gaining a floral dress. The ad carries the tag, "Nothing naughty about it." Ben, how did you feel about this ad?
I preferred her as I'm a guy, so does it matter what I think? It's aimed at women. I found the woman at the beginning of the ad far more aspirational than the woman at the end of the ad. So,
when you say aspire to complete this sentence,
well, she was a more interesting person, and if I was a girl, I'd probably more want to be like her than the girl, slightly dowdy girl that. The end of it in the floral dress. So, I don't know. I'm sure they would have researched it. I'm sure they would have ended up with people saying, yes, this is right. But I'm not sure it'll convince women to start biting into their Hungry Jacks.
Yeah, to me, there's something wrong about it. I couldn't quite put my finger on what. I think it's a sort of objectification of a woman as rock chick means naughty. A woman in floral dress means good.
Don't women want to be naughty, though?
Well.
Next, Lara Bingle, 10's big reality hope.
This week saw the news of 10 moving their new reality series, Being Lara Bingle, to Tuesdays rather than Thursdays, a day that is notoriously bad for TV. Tim, does this suggest that 10 believes it's got legs?
I'm not sure, because if you read it in the Telegraph, it's because it's testing through the roof and advertisers are clamouring to advertise against the show, whereas if you look on TV tonight, I got the impression they thought it was a bit of a random move. Not much is rating great, apart from MasterChef at the moment.
Which is just keeping its neck above.
Just keeping its neck above water, which is fair enough for the fourth series, and that's it's bringing in the right audience as well. Yeah. I Do you know the thing that most worries me? I think it's going to go quite well, and I just think that says something terrible about the state of television. That, you know, I found myself watching on pay TV this week, and, well, I say watching, that's overstating it. It was on while I was writing the Fairfax story in the background. I was watching something on pay TV, and then Wag Nation came on and stayed on it. It gradually dawned on me just how terrible it is, which is a, you know, an even cheaper version of, you know, wives and girlfriends of Australian cricketers, I think, and what they get up to. And so I kind of fear that, you know, Laura Bingle is going to be celebrated for being quite a vacuous person in a rented by the production company apartment in Bondi. Paul, are you proud to be a stable mate?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's interesting that you say that it says something sad about 10.
No, I mean sad about television.
Say something sad about Australia. You know, is what you must really mean.
And viewers. Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, viewers is what I mean.
10, television.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends. You have to determine why are they there in the first place. You know, why is the television network there in the first place? And obviously, if the aim is to get viewers, to secure viewers, then you try and target something towards the society. And I think it will be fabulously successful.
Will you be watching?
You see, and this is why I think it'll be fabulously successful, because I think I'll have to. You know, I think I will have to. Now, I may not have to watch every single moment of every single episode, but I think it'll be one of those programs that you have to be able to say, yeah, I did see that.
So, Ben, I want to ask you about, 10 has said the move from Thursday to Tuesday was due to strong advertising dollars. You're not in media buying, but what brands would you see benefiting from being aligned with Lara?
Apart from Tourism Australia, of course.
Obviously, the Commonwealth Bank.
She was the other one who was in the running, was she?
The other aspirational figure in the running.
Yeah. No, we didn't talk to Lara this time. I mean, she was a lovely girl.
Yes, bit of back history. Lara did the Tourism Australia campaign.
She was one shot at the end of the commercial where she said, "Where the bloody hell are you?"
Yeah, but it was the shot, wasn't it, really? It was the money shot.
Well, it turned out to be that way, but it
was
never...
Did you cast her in that?
I remember... I mean, she was perfect for that casting because she was a classic girl that walked out of the water at Bondi, and you just think, yeah, she's Australia. It was... she was 17 or something at that time. She was very young, and... that campaign got political because of the changes in government and all sorts of things happened. So I don't
Kevin Rudd called it a rolled gold disaster, seemed a bit mean.
It was a bit mean and it was very inaccurate, but it was very successful in some markets. Where, anyway, we digress. You're asking about Lara.
Yes.
I think swimwear would be on the money. Maybe Hungry Jack's could be there trying to tempt women with healthy burgers.
What do you mean? If you eat Hungry Jack's, you'll turn into Lara Bengal?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we could have a cross promo. there'll be some product placement.
There'll be all these people outside Hungry Jack's that can't work out how to get in.
Yeah. I don't think Cricket Australia or the AFL will be advertising in her show, but you never know.
So what are your TV viewing habits, Ben? Do you watch a lot of TV?
I've become hooked on, I mean, HBO, which obviously is pay TV. Game of Thrones, I'm addicted to. I was addicted to Boardwalk Empire prior to that. And I'm amazed that we don't, I mean, this whole thing about mavens and the way people... The people we believe most aren't advertisers, they're our friends. So why don't we actually spend more time and money advertising on shows that people who, the kind of pointy end shows that not everyone knows about, and they discover them before they move to the bigger channels and people start raving about them and then their friends see them. And those are the brands that those people are getting into. And I think Mini have done a pretty good job doing that with
The Walking Dead.
Yeah. But you just
look
it's
at
worth
those describing
shows.
Those
they're
ads.
They're massively loved shows.
And describe the mini ads that you're talking about.
Well, they're pretty weird. They don't have zombies in them, which was a lost opportunity, I think. But they had, seem to have two characters driving around the world, which would have been a great shoot too. But they're good, quirky mini ads.
And having little adventures.
Little adventures.
Mini adventures, you could say.
That's very, very much the idea. And I've seen it. I used to have a mini, so I love mini too. But I think there is a lost opportunity there. And I think there's a lot of, you go back to, it's yes, it's risky, but it's not a lot of money spending a bit of money on those shows. And you probably make much deeper relationships with the brand because you have such a dedicated, addicted audience to those shows.
And Paul, what are your TV watching habits? Do you watch catch-up TV of yourself and watch yourself and think, God, I was brilliant?
Never. And I have all that technology, which I have actually mastered, you know, the ability to record television programs. But no, I never watch my own. I'm obsessed with news, so I find myself, and it annoys me, my obsession with news. So I'll go from Agenda on Sky, which never seems to end. It's just always on.
Sometimes they do have to make way for the repeat of Agenda.
Well, occasionally. And then all of a sudden Parliament's there and you realise that really isn't news at all. And then, you know, I'm into the news bulletins on free-to-air television. And then basically I go to bed. But there are a couple of shows. I quite like appointment television. You know, I think there's a real place now, particularly with the ability everybody has, or virtually everybody has, to record program and not watch it in real time for appointment television. So I've unfortunately become hooked on MasterChef certain nights of the week, not every single night, because that would just suck my will to live. But there are only a couple of shows that get sort of serious records on the machine and that. And I get fed up with those as well. I don't know if you curb your enthusiasm, I thought was fantastic, until all of a sudden I sat there and thought, this bloody show frustrates me so much I will never watch it again. I don't know what clicked in my head, but there are very few that get a serious record.
That is, unfortunately, all we have time for today. Thank you very much to producer Colin.
I've not said a word the entire time.
To Paul.
You've just made a lie of that, Colin, haven't you? Thank you.
Great. And to Ben.
Thanks, Tim.
And to Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
The podcast was brought to you from the studios of CBS Interactive. Noise International created the theme tune. See you next week. Toodle-pip.